You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Midori House, broadcasting live from Davos at the World Economic Forum with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's not just economics here, there's a healthy dose of global politics too. We'll be taking the political pulse of the forum with foreign affairs analyst Ian Bremmer.
My issue is not about whether or not there should be a referendum for the Brits to be in or out of the EU. My issue is that Cameron basically said we're going to have years of uncertainty. And that's a horrible thing for the Brits' economy.
One barometer of economic confidence, are bankers willing to show their face at Davos? The Wall Street Journal's Dennis Berman will be here with the answer. Not everyone in Davos is a fan of the forum, though. Yves Weglin, business editor of Die Wochen Zeitung, will be explaining why the masters of the universe sometimes do more harm than good. We'll also be joined by a young global leader, and we'll be explaining what a young global leader actually is, before we also hit the slopes to find out whether financiers and skiing actually mix.
What's great about them is they're not really a bunch of cheapskates, you know, so they're not scared to spend a couple of bucks on something.
All that, plus we play a Swiss song or two. All coming up in the next hour here on a very special Midori House, live from Davos with me, Steve Bloomfield. But first, let's go back to London for the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Palestinians voice pessimism after the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed victory in Israel's general election despite losing 11 seats, mainly to centre-left challengers. Analyst Mahdi Abdelhadi said that the Palestinian issue was now back on the agenda.
Israeli lived for the whole month a denial position on Palestine. They never mentioned Palestinian, they never mentioned peace process, they never mentioned sharing Jerusalem or freezing settlement. These issues are back on the Israeli agenda, whether they like it or not, because of this election and because of the weakness of the right wing embodied in Netanyahu himself. He will be a transitional prime minister. He will not live long. He will have a very weak government and he will not be able to deliver the right wing agenda as before.
Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers have shot and killed a 21-year-old Palestinian woman near the West Bank city of Hebron and wounded another local youth. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has defended her handling of the 11th of September attack in Libya on the US mission in Benghazi last year that killed four Americans, including a US ambassador, an event that threatens to stain her legacy at the State Department.
For me, this is not just a matter of policy, it's personal. I stood next to President Obama as the Marines carried those flag-draped caskets off the plane at Andrews. I put my arms around the mothers and fathers, the sisters and brothers, the sons and daughters, and the wives left alone to raise their children. It has been one of the great honors of my life to lead the men and women of the State Department and USAID.
The first Patriot missile batteries being sent by NATO countries to defend Turkey from possible attack from Syria are expected to be ready for use this weekend. NATO officer Brigadier General Gary Deakin said the anti-missile system would reach its full operating capability by the end of January.
They've arrived now in Eskenderun in Turkey, are unloading and unloaded and are moving out to their positions. We expect to have an initial operating capability this weekend, that we will provide protection against missiles for up to 3.5 million people.
A three-year-old boy called Dennis is one of the last Russian orphans to join his adoptive family in America after the law banning U.S. adoptions was signed by President Putin in late December. Anne Petit from Georgia is his new adoptive mother.
I have many friends that are just devastated right now because they're waiting to bring their children back. They're in the referral process and in the court process, and they want to come back and get their children. So, you know, if I was to say a plea, I would just ask President Putin that he would just let the ones come home.
Sports news now, and this year's Six Nations Rugby Championship begins on the 2nd of February with England and France vying for favouritism and Wales seeking to retain their title off the back of seven successive defeats. Captain Sam Warburton knows the Welsh need to lift the gloom in their opening match against Ireland in Cardiff.
A couple of performances in those seven defeats that we've had recently which were below par, but a lot of those were very close, by a point or 2 points. And the same goes for me. We won the Grand Slam. There's probably two games there which we won by a point or a couple of points in the last minute. So I just think it shows, the fine line between winning and losing in international rugby.
And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Now, we're at Holland House in Davos. Let me, before we start, give you a bit of an idea of what our surroundings are like. I'm just going to go outside onto our balcony, our very, very cold balcony, which we sort of half hoped we could do the show from out here, but it's about minus 10, so you just hear me shivering. But basically, let me set the scene. Holland House is in the heart of Davos. We've got the view here. We've got an amazing mountain in front of us. Everything is covered by at least a foot of snow. This place used to be an old health centre. People came from all over Europe to be cured for asthma because it's about 1,600 metres up in the air. You can sort of see why that would work. And Holland House is now home to numerous media organisations. We've got a Sky News just down the corridor, BBC News are just above us, and New Delhi TV are along here as well. But we're going to do the show from inside. I'm going to go back into the warm now, where Ian Bremmer is waiting for us. The state of the global economy is, of course, a fairly important topic at the World Economic Forum, as you'd expect. But those gathered in Davos are also here to discuss some of the bigger geopolitical issues too. With more than 50 heads of state and dozens of finance and trade ministers here from every continent, there'll be plenty of opportunities for both public panels and private side room chats. Ian Bremmer, founder of the Eurasia Group and author of Every Nation for Itself, a worryingly prescient book about the lack of global leadership, has been keeping his ear on both, and he joins us here at Holland House now. Ian, welcome.
Thanks. Worryingly prescient. That's a beautiful turn of phrase. I'm going to use that. Worryingly prescient.
You can put it on the next version. So let's start with some of the bigger issues that people have been talking about over the last day or so. Obviously, this morning, the UK Prime Minister David Cameron made a long-awaited, or certainly a speech that's been we've been talking about for a very long time, on Europe, and saying that there should be a referendum in the UK on whether Britain should remain part of the European Union. And what have you made of that yourself, and also from talking to other people sort of at the forum over the past few hours?
Well, I wish he'd kept waiting. Frankly, I mean, keep in mind, this is a very pro-globalization, pro-EU crowd. So you're going to get a lot of bias here that's going to be opposed to Cameron's making these statements no matter what. My issue is not about whether or not there should be a referendum for the Brits to be in or out of the EU. My issue is that Cameron basically said we're going to have years of uncertainty. And that's a horrible thing for the Brits' economy. You know, you're saying that if the Conservatives win a general election and once you renegotiate your basic terms of agreement with the EU, then there will be an as yet unstated referendum you will be able to vote on by 2017. Uncertainty will force market participants to forestall their decisions on whether or not to invest more in Britain. You cannot do this in all good conscience while your economy is going through the kind of trouble that the British economy presently is. This is obviously a good thing for the Tories from a populist perspective, appealing to their voter base. It's a deeply irresponsible thing for them to do economically. I thought it was a shambolic speech, frankly.
And so if you're actually going to have a referendum, why not do it right now?
If you want to give the people a voice on whether or not they want to be in the EU, do it now. I'm not saying that you should be anti-democratic. What I'm saying is that there's an enormous amount of political power in determining how and when and what you're voting on. And Cameron is clearly trying to maximize that leverage, and it's understandable why he's doing it. 17% of those who said that they voted Tory in the last election said they would vote for the UK Independence Party, which is kind of a nutty group, in if there were an election today. He understands that, but this speech went both too far and not far enough. It's a real problem economically for Britain, and you guys are going to feel it.
And also, we heard Tony Blair a little bit earlier today, who's also here at Davos, saying it reminded him a little bit of Mel Brooks in Blazing Saddles, putting a gun to his own head and saying, you know, if you don't agree with me, I'll blow my own brains out. And he said, well, look, it's quite possible that one of the other 27 nations in the European Union, 26 nations in the European Union, may all just say, well, go ahead.
Are you saying that Tony Blair suggested that Cameron didn't give a great speech? That is shocking to me.
What do you make of it from a European perspective here? I mean, obviously, you know, he's got his own audience in the UK. Cameron's coming here tomorrow to give a different speech, which he says is going to be about tax and transparency, nothing to do with the European Union at all. And what sort of reception can he expect?
He's going to take a lot of questions. I mean, I certainly believe that by virtue of giving that speech today, even though not in Davos, on the EU, Cameron has just become the most important figure to play a role at Davos this year. His speech will be by far the most covered, the most significant, both for what he says, what he doesn't say, not only in his speech, but of course in Q&A. This is a freewheeling crowd. They will ask what they want to, even if it's a bit stage managed. I think it's going to be a very important meeting indeed. Look, I don't believe that Cameron wants to leave the EU. I don't believe this is about that. But again, the point is that suddenly, at a Davos where people are feeling better about the US, they're feeling better about the EU, they're feeling better about Japan than they were last year, they're feeling worse about Britain. And it's all because of that speech.
Let's move from someone who's going to be here tomorrow to people who really aren't here. You've noticed a lack of Chinese people here, you know, whether that's government people, business people. Why do you think that is?
And they have 1.3 billion folks, so they wouldn't be missed. You know, you could bring a couple to Davos and it'd be okay, right? I mean, the country won't collapse. They didn't send a meaningful delegation. Surprisingly, no high-level Chinese leaders are here. Now, last year, they didn't come either. But last year, it's because they hosted the World Economic Forum concurrently with the Chinese New Year. They moved it this year, and the Chinese still didn't show. And you know, you can say it's because there's a new leadership in China, Xi Jinping, but they knew about that for a long time. It is an authoritarian regime. Again, they can handle these things. I've spoken to members of the Chinese delegation today, and they said, look, we don't get to shape the agenda at Davos. We would rather attend summits that are ours. We'd rather go to Bao Forum, which we do ourselves. We'd rather go to the summer Davos and Dalian and Tianjin, where we get to decide what's on the agenda. The World Economic Forum is an organization that is really interested in supporting rule of law, good governance, sustainability. It's interested in globalization, in multinational corporations, the private sector, even democracy. These are values that are largely not supported by the Chinese government. And so, I mean, I know we call it a World Economic Forum, but the reality is it's not global.
But I mean, does that matter if the Chinese aren't here? I mean, it might matter in the sense that, you know, the people that run the World Economic Forum here at Davos might be a bit disappointed that there isn't more of a Chinese presence. But does that really matter?
Well, it certainly didn't matter 10 or 20 or 30 years ago because the Chinese were small. But let's keep in mind that China will become the world's largest economy. So if you want to be the World Economic Forum and you don't have the world's largest economy participating in a meaningful way, you ain't global. Now, I have no problem with things that are world that aren't global. We have a World Series in baseball. There is a Canadian team, but it's not global.
It doesn't quite make global, yeah.
It does for me, but it doesn't for lots of other people. And I mean, that is the point, is that we are in, I call my book Every Nation for Itself, but it's about a G0 world. In a G0 world, the World Economic Forum, like the World Bank, like other organizations, they're not global.
In terms of other things that haven't been here in some ways, is there's been very little talk so far about the Middle East. Now, is that because it's not important to the global economy, or is it just that the crowd that we have here is more focused on what's happening in Europe?
Well, first of all, we are going to have a lot of important visitors from the Middle East. Jordan's King Hussein is scheduled to come here, I believe, on Friday, and they're having elections today. That's very meaningful. So we'll talk more about the Middle East. But so far, it's really been much more of a developed country conversation. In part, I think it's because there are no good solutions that are being offered for the Middle East. And in part, it's because the energy revolution, starting in the U.S., but also you'll see it in Europe, you'll see it in China, shale gas, unconventional gas and oil, means that over time, the importance of the Middle East is decreasing. But let's keep in mind, the level of conflict in the Middle East, in North Africa, in South Asia, is growing to levels that we've not seen in decades. We have over 60,000 dead in Syria. The United States playing much less of a role in this part of the world. The French now are taking the lead on the war on terror in Mali and perhaps in some other Arab places in North Africa, the Sahel. They've got 2,000 troops in Mali. This is not going to fix this situation. Nobody has very good ideas on what to do next.
Ian Bremmer, we'll leave it there. Ian Bremmer, founder of the Eurasia Group and author of Every Nation for Itself. Thank you very much. Okay. You're listening to a special edition of Midori House live from Davos.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 1916 here in Davos, 1816 in London. You're listening to Midori House. Jamie Dimon, the beleaguered chief executive of JP Morgan, earlier today launched a full-throated defence of his industry. Dimon has been one of banking's most vociferous supporters since the financial crisis, but few of his peers are as comfortable putting their head above the parapet. Yet bankers are certainly here, and Dennis Berman, marketplace editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, has been hearing what they have to say, and I'm pleased to say he joins us here at Holland House right now.
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming, Dennis. Now, Jamie Dimon is obviously one of the very few who's willing to say what he thinks. Do you think this is because he's got a slightly unusual view, or does everyone else agree with him but they're just too scared to say?
Well, I don't know why I'd expect him not to launch a vociferous defense for bankers, if not Jamie, who, I would say. But his personality, just the way he is as a person, and beyond that as a CEO, that's just who he is, and he likes to mix it up. We were in the Congress Center earlier today, and he was surrounded by reporters, and he was just eating it up. You know, he likes the spotlight. He likes being the person who speaks his mind. And when the bank screws up, as it did, taking accountability. And relative to what happened, I think Dimon was pretty much on point when he took the blame for the trading failure of the London Whale. I'm sure he's no longer circling the Thames, but he certainly has had some impact in New York City.
When you look at the banking industry and how it's coped following the financial crisis, you know, those that are willing to speak up publicly do say, oh, well, look, you know, we've said sorry and we've changed. And yet then you look at the new rules that are supposed to come in, whether that's Basel III or whether in the UK with the John Vickers rules, which has been suggested. Right. And then they go, well, look, oh, yeah, we accept these are fine. But can we just change this? And can we just change this? And can we just change this?
Yeah, it's a really good point. There are a couple different things going on. First off, banking has not become a glamorous business whatsoever. It sort of had the last surge of adrenaline post-death in 2009 when profits returned in 2009, a great year to be a banker. But what we're seeing right now in New York is really a diminution of the financial services industry at large on Wall Street. The pay is coming down. The number of people who work on Wall Street is coming down. The number of products they're offering is certainly coming down. So it is not a good time to be a banker, just from a secular standpoint. In terms of what they lobby for and how they try to chisel the rules to their direction, I don't think we should expect anything less. Lots of high-minded rhetoric at places like Davos. It's a great time to issue plenty of pronouncements. But when it comes down to it, a lot of the livelihood of the bank depends on, right now, it really depends on interpretation of some bizarre rules in Congress or whether it's in the UK. So I don't think we should expect anything but that. Do you have a different view?
No. Well, I whether we should expect them to behave any differently is one thing, but whether they should behave differently is perhaps another thing.
Well, general purpose and outlook of any organization is to perpetuate itself, right? Power wants to stay in power. So I'm sure if Monocle came under attack, it would view the same way, or even the BBC coming under attack for broadcast licenses, which is another interesting
Well, indeed. But I mean, on
topic.
That point, there are issues over, you know, there are regulations over broadcasting. There are regulations over, what we as Monocle can and cannot say. Do you feel that, you know, there's a... The call for more regulation has kind of waned somewhat over the last couple of years. That people have thought, well, you know, they are saying they're going to make some changes.
Well, that's the great irony of the banking business, is that every moment where you want to give the benefit of the doubt to Wall Street is another moment where they just screw up, whether it be HSBC on money laundering, whether it be UBS on trading losses, whether it be JP Morgan. I can go on and on and on. The list is rather just... astounding that each turn that bad behavior does seem to crop up inside the banking industry. So whether they should be regulated from a macro perspective in terms of sort of financial velocity, that's one question. But they've certainly lost a lot of their moral position to say they can't or shouldn't be, simply because of scandal after scandal after scandal that's happened.
And when you look at those scandals after scandals after scandals, do you get a sense that some senior leaders within the banking industry are willing to say, look, actually, we need to put our house in order. And if we can't do it ourselves, then we should let governments or global organizations.
They say that after they leave, but not during. I mean, the LIBOR scandal is probably the biggest of them all. And affects more money and more trades than anything at all, and affects more banks than any of them all. And I don't think we've really seen, maybe at Barclays, right? But that's what the new CEO has to say. But a great kind of prostration that, oh, please regulate us, protect us from ourselves. It only comes after something's gone wrong. And Sandy Weill, put together Citigroup, of course, is calling for the breakup of the bank, but he is the one who put it together. So there's not a lot of consistency on the topic.
When you've been, talking to people, I mean, it's your first time here at Davos, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
What do you make of it so far? I mean, because obviously, you know, Davos has a reputation, and then you come here and you see it for yourself. What have you made of it so far?
It's more of a glorified trade show. It's the highest end trade show in the world. If you walk down the halls of your building here, you see the meeting rooms. It's no different than if you went to clothing apparel trade show in New York City or a mining and oil conference somewhere in Africa. It's really just the same thing. People wanting to do business together. There's kind of this, at least from what I've seen, this sheen of doing good for the world. And I guess, again, this is just 6 hours worth of impression. I guess people feel that way, but really most people are here to do business. And that's fine, but I don't, I haven't seen the great ideals has espoused necessarily lived up to it so far.
Well, let's see what happens after you've been here for more than 6 hours. Dennis Berman, Wall Street Journal's marketplace editor and columnist, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Indeed. Up next, we get a critical look, a different critical look at Davos from a Swiss perspective. Stay tuned.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we head to East London's chilly and wonderful Wapping project to get all immersive, check out Beijing's reboot of its Ullens Art Centre, and hear what you'll be listening to this time next year with BBC Radio 1's new music magus, Hugh Stevens.
Dreamy, synthy pop was kind of popular.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers,
energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick and span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
And you're back with Midori House live from the World Economic Forum in Davos with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 1925 here in Davos. Now, this is a conference that almost has a target on its back, a quite literal gathering of the global 1%. So what does the conference miss? Where does it get? What does it get wrong or overlook? And of course, what do the locals think about it? Well, joining us is one such local Swiss person, Yves Weglin, who's the business editor of Die Wochenzeitung WOZ. Yves, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Now, you've been quite critical of the forum here in the past. I mean, what do you feel that it gets wrong?
Yeah, there are different points, but I would say, today the whole day I was in the Congress Center, and it seems to me like there are many, many people, but from a democratic point of view, it's... the problem is that you have the range of interests and opinions is not really wide. So you have always the same discussion, and you have no really critical democratic, I would say, deliberation or something like this. So that would be the main point.
But I mean, in a sense, does that really matter? I mean, as our last guest, you know, Des Bowman was saying, it's like it's a trade show for the banking elite, for the literal global 1%. If they want to talk to themselves, you know, what does it matter if there's no criticism there?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that they don't only talk just about business. It's all about politics, all about the state of the world, and you have all this top shots coming there. From big business companies talking about politics, and you have Klaus Schwab, the founder of the Economic Forum, said we have a multi-stakeholder. It's a multi-stakeholder place, but it's not really true. You have two or three unionists there, but you have. You have not this opposition, and you have not this broad range of opinions as I said before. So it's also a kind of privatization of the democracy. it's maybe a little bit thought maybe a little bit too big, but you have this kind of thinking and It's you privatize democracy. You just bring it to a place where only a little elite is can afford the tickets or is invited by Mr. Schwab, and they're discussing just their opinions, and you have no opposition.
Now, your newspaper has been pretty critical of the forum for a while. I mean, do you think that views within Switzerland have changed over the past few years since the global financial crisis began in 2008?
Yeah, I would say there is something like apathy now. People don't really care about the Economic Forum. I mean, you had in the beginning of 2000, you had big clashes, you had the big demonstrations, and there was a big discussion also about the things that I just talked about.
I mean, but do you see those demonstrations here? I mean, obviously within the green zone or the red zone or whatever you want to call it, there's good luck getting in. But certainly, elsewhere in the town in Davos, I mean, we've been out all day and it's been pretty sleepy.
Yeah,
there are no sort of anti-globalization protesters here or anything like that,
no,
is there?
No, But I mean, it's also a global development. I mean, you had in the year 2000, you had this whole anti-globalization movement around the world, and now I would say it sleeps. So it reflects a little bit the state of the of this movement, I would say. Yeah. And 3 years ago, you had also this whole Occupy movement, but
that's pretty much withered and died. Yeah. Eve Eglin, we're going to have to leave it there. Eve Eglin, business editor of VOTS newspaper, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To va Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll meet a young global leader, take a look at a wonder bag, and we'll visit a local ski shop.
What's great about them is they're not really a bunch of cheapskates. You know, so they're not scared to spend a couple of bucks on something.
But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has defended her handling of the 11th of September attack in Libya on the US mission in Benghazi last year that killed four Americans, including a US ambassador, an event that threatens to stain her legacy at the State Department. Palestinians have voiced pessimism after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed victory in Israel's general election, despite losing 11 seats, mainly to centre-left challengers. Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers have shot and killed a 21-year-old Palestinian woman near the West Bank city of Hebron. The first Patriot missile batteries being sent by NATO countries to defend Turkey from possible attack from Syria are expected to be ready for use in Turkey this weekend. And a three-year-old boy called Dennis is one of the last Russian orphans to join his adoptive family in America after the law banning US adoptions was signed by President Putin in late December. That's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. You're back with Midori House live from the World Economic Forum here in Davos. The Forum of Young Global Leaders is a community of more than 700 people worldwide. Nominated by the World Economic Forum through a rather rigorous selection criteria, these individuals must be under 40 years old. The aim to create the next generation of the leadership community. So what's it like to be part of the YGL community? Well, we've managed to track one down and bring him here to Holland House. I'm joined now by Tom Hume, design editor of the design and innovation consulting firm IDO. Tom, welcome.
Hi there.
Let's start with this concept of YGLs. What is a young global leader and how does one become one?
The process for how one becomes one is suitably opaque, which is a classic way of sort of breeding interest. We've all learned that. But it was designed by Schwab actually in 2005. He started bringing on YGLs. There's 109 nationalities represented now. And essentially, they've selected people from politics, business, social entrepreneurship, the NGO sector broadly, to come together periodically and share ideas. The idea being that both they'd have something to add to the broader community, like the World Economic Forum, the reason I'm here, but also to share experiences between one another across industries and across countries.
And so what does that mean in practice? What do you do over the few days of the World Economic Forum here in Davos?
So we came in on Sunday. We spent Monday and Tuesday working together, working on some specific challenges, actually, around how we might help charities sort of increase their presence, amplify their messages. We had a really interesting exercise where we thought through some disaster scenarios of what the world might look like in 2025, which is scarily easy to do at the moment, and started coming up with some practical actions that we could each take to our own countries, our own companies, that might make a difference.
Let's talk about your own organization, IDO. Explain to us what it is and what it's all about.
IDO is a global innovation company. There's 600 designers globally, and we help our clients, whether it be startups right up to large corporations and governments, innovate, come up with new ideas to improve their prospects for growth.
And so how does that then relate to being a young global leader? I mean, what are the sort of specific things that you're working on here over the next few days? And so what sort of other people are you doing those things with?
I'm responsible for a platform called OpenIDEO, openideo.com, which is an open innovation network, 43,000 people from 160 countries solving challenges for social good. So the advantage of me being here is I can identify new projects we might work on. There's some amazing potential projects that I've seen. Also share experiences of how to scale these sorts of platforms, how to internationalize them more successfully. And I've worked on other people's projects in a similar way. It's a really lovely sort of reciprocal arrangement whereby we all help one another.
Is there a danger that this sort of thing becomes, I mean, as you say, it's, you know, that the process to become a YGO is rather opaque, and it's sort of almost set up to some as if it's a bit of greenwash, a bit of, oh, well, this will be good sort of corporate social responsibility because, you know, Davos can get criticised every now and then, so let's have something nice and fluffy.
Yeah, I mean, I think many would level that accusation. I think the selection process, as I understand it, people are nominated. I believe that's the case. And they go through a fairly rigorous selection process. And one of the criteria is a potential for solid impact in the world, positive impact in the world. And from what I've seen, I can't speak for the process itself, but I can speak for the selection. I'm obviously biased, but I'm genuinely inspired by the people that are there, and I've seen them interact with the broader WEF program today, be on panels, many of us are doing talks, and I hope that maybe we can nudge, you know, we can represent another generation and nudge some of these global leaders. There's 47 here this week. Mm-hmm. Nudge those leaders to think differently.
And in terms of concrete things which you hope will come out of your participation here, is there anything yet where you think, actually, yes, we're going to be able to do this and I wouldn't have been able to do that otherwise?
Yeah, so it's actually probably easier for me to look backward at some of the other YGL events. I've been stunned, actually, pretty much everyone I've been to, some sort of program or social enterprise has sprung up as a result. And one of the topics that we tackled this week, I'm really passionate about, is actually how to bring more entrepreneurs into the fold, into the World Economic Forum. We know how dire the economic climate is at the moment. Everyone's talking about entrepreneurship as the solution. One of the projects that we'll be focusing on is how do we share more success stories, role models, entrepreneurs inside this community to start showing it as a viable alternative.
And just finally, once you leave Davos and go home, what happens next with these projects? Do you, you know, are you talking to people throughout the year? Are there other events where you're getting together to work to push things through?
Yeah, absolutely. There's events in the different cities of the community. So I go to the London ones regularly, probably 4 or 5 times a year. It's an opportunity to sort of get progress checks. And then obviously we have the advantage technology is taking the friction out of the communication in the interim. And so we're pretty much in daily or weekly contact, pushing the ideas forward. And it works quite well. You form a social contract in person and you feel obliged thereafter to sort of keep the pressure on.
Okay, well, best of luck. Tom Hume, Design Director of the design and innovation consulting firm IDEO, thank you very much indeed. Up next, a little bit of music, because, you know, we're in Switzerland, so a little bit of Swiss music. And then we're also going to hear how the ski industry here in Davos changes somewhat during the World Economic Forum. You're listening to Midori House.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts, and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
That sounds like a riot so far.
On Sunday, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House, a very special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from Holland House here in Davos at the World Economic Forum. I just poked my head out during that little break to see how cold it was. Apparently it's gone down to minus 11 now, so quite happy we're here in the warm, where it's a very toasty 21 degrees. There you are, temperature news as well. We're going to play a little bit of music now. I promised you Swiss music. This is Boy with Oh Boy.
She's so easy to fall for, but boy, she's so hard to hold. She looks at you like... Oh, boy.
And that was Boy with Oh Boy. I mean, they're sort of Swiss. They're Swiss-German. One's Swiss, one's German, but, you know, it counts. You're listening to Midori House, a live Midori House special from the World Economic Forum here in Davos, where the time is 1944. Now, when the World Economic Forum isn't in town, Davos is a skiing town. In fact, the media hive where we're located right now is usually host to hundreds of ski instructors. They get kicked out when conference comes to town, but they jump right back in when the limousines leave. And a little bit earlier, we visited a ski shop and met some of the skiers heading to the slopes.
I'm coming here for about 20 years in the third week of January. Well, I'm enjoying it because there are no people on slopes and only people in the town. And so we and our guides can just ski anywhere. We don't need to wait in the restaurants or in the lift or whatsoever. So that's the perfect week for skiing. And if I had to complain about something, then it's about the bus. Eh? It doesn't drive that often.
My name's Glenn, and I'm working here at the Swiss Rennesport Ski Rental here in Davos. Well, this year it's actually been better than the past years. I think it's maybe something to do with the weather, but I feel that it's just like in the normal high season, almost during the week. You know, in the middle of the week, it's always been quieter, and starting to feel this year that it's actually better than in the past years. Some of them, I don't think, come here expecting to go skiing. So if they do go skiing, it's mainly a spontaneous thing. But a lot of jackets and pants, gloves, of course, hats, goggles, sunglasses, spikes for the shoes so they don't slip when they're walking down the street. Hand warmers, they work, they sell really, really well. A lot of balaclava things, you know, you can put under your helmet or under your hat or whatever, just to keep your face warm. And scarves, that sort of thing, you know, because I don't think they really think that they're coming to a cold place. When it comes to clothes, I mean, we sell things like Bogner and Cuse and Peak and stuff like that. So that's the sort of brands that they're buying. And I mean, with their glasses, it's usually like Oakley or... I mean, what's great about them is they're not really a bunch of cheapskates. You know, so they're not scared to spend a couple of bucks on something.
My name is Richard Hook, and I'm coming from Salzburg. This is the Mozart town. I'm staying for 1 week here in Engadin, and there was one day in Davos skiing, and it was very beautiful today because nobody on the piste. I think everybody is going to the Congress, and we had free area for skiing. because the weather is so good and Davos is a well-known place for skiing. I was never there before, and I have seen this congress because our car was occupied by the police, and they looked our ski equipment if there is no gun in it.
My name is Alexandra Bossi, and I'm the owner of the Bogner shop in Davosplatz. I have another store in Davosdorf. We have a lot of police in this hotel, and there the shop is closed, almost closed for this time of the year, because nobody can get into the store. This store is a very good location because all the people from the Economic Forum, a lot of them walking through this area. And I think we have a very good brand, and people like high quality good brands. They look for special gears, they look for gears they only can buy in Switzerland. They look for winter gears, for hats, for gloves, for down jackets, things they don't have in their own country. I don't know. Depends on the day. Today it's a little slow, but I think tomorrow and until Saturday there is going a lot of business these days.
And that was our visit to the local ski shops here in Davos. Up next, we'll meet the founder of Wonderbag, find out just exactly what a Wonderbag is. You're listening to Midori House.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And you're back with Midori House live in Davos, Switzerland, with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 1949 here in Davos, 1849 in London. Now, it's not just economists and politicians here. NGOs, charities and businesses that want to make a difference are also out in force. Sarah Collins is a South Africa-based entrepreneur and the founder of Wonderbag, which makes insulated bags for cooking that reduces a family's fuel usage by up to 30%. Changing lives with eco-cooking is the motto of the company. Sarah joins us now to tell us a little bit more about the company and what their strategy is in Davos. Sarah, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, before we get on to what you're doing here in Davos, briefly, what's a Wonderbag?
Steve, very simply, a Wonderbag is a non-electric slow cooker, in a simple terms. I developed it in Africa because there's a huge crisis in Africa with fuel consumption and cooking fuels. So very simply, you bring your pot to the boil for 10 minutes, put it into the bag, the pot into the bag, close the bag, and it continues to cook for 8 to 12 hours in the bag at above 65 degrees. So it really allows people to cook in Africa without using precious resources.
And then what brings you from, you know, designing a bag like that and creating that and forming the company to then deciding to rock up to Davos with a Wonder Bag under your arm and saying, look at my wonderful Wonder Bag. What do you guys think of it?
It's a very good question, and it does make me laugh when I introduced myself to somebody and said it's unusual for somebody out the African bush to be in Davos in the snow. However, the Wonder Bag has taken off very much in the United Kingdom, in Europe. It is not just a third world solution. It's actually being very successful in the first world as well. However, why I'm at Davos? I was invited by Paul Pullman, the global CEO of Unilever, to accompany him to talk about making the world a better place. Unilever are one of our initial partners in Africa. We've done a pilot with them. We have 600,000 Wonder Bags in use in South Africa, and we're seeing unbelievable economic development results. And as we all know, Davos is not just about internal corporate NGO government strategies. It's about looking outside of themselves and looking for solutions that are going to leave the world a better place. And we've worked closely with people like the World Food Programme, other United Nations agencies in the humanitarian space. So we really want to bring to Davos a solution that as a community, as a global community, if we get together and launch 100 million Wonder Bags at Davos, the impact that we can make.
And so is it also not just about, you know, promoting Wonder Bag as a solution, but also about showing other major companies, you know, of the ilk of Unilever, that actually there are all sorts of corporate social responsibility things they could be doing, which will not just look good, but can actually be economically sensible as well.
Absolutely. This is really about, it's not just about Wonder Bag, and I'm glad, thank you, Steve, for pointing that out. This is about looking for solutions that work for corporations, governments, that do actually put forward their own agendas as well. Now, in corporations, it's about bottom lines. However, we need to look at different ways of achieving those goals. We've all got to look out of the box. And I think that I am just one of the solutions that's working. And so it's really about taking a look at how we can... We're a commercial business. Mm. Wonder Bag is a social enterprise. So we have a foundation as well as a limited company. Mm. So we are also looking at financial solutions, and we're enabling people like Unilever to build more trust with their consumers. They're giving back to the consumers by showing them that they can save money every month to be spent on different things. And our agenda is very much about looking at empowerment of women.
Now, you say, you know, you've been invited here by Unilever. Do you worry that actually, yeah, this is still a little bit of a closed shop here at Davos? And it's all very well that you were invited, but there are all sorts of other social entrepreneurs who may have some fantastic ideas and things that could be, you know, incredibly interesting for other big companies to look at, but they're just not going to get a foot in the door here.
I think that's a real challenge to all people in my space. You know, there are fantastic projects that I've seen through the last 15 years of my life that I would like to have at Davos with me as well. But I think the more we can get people to actually start including people like myself in real grassroots solutions, that opens the door for other people with projects. And certainly my agenda going forward is not just about Wonder Bag. It's about saying, let's be inclusive and not have a closed shop. So I think sometimes it takes icebreakers to make the difference. And I hope that I'm one of those and that I will lead, you know, into a new way of thinking and bringing young entrepreneurs, not that I'm so young, but, you know, entrepreneurs from the developing world who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity.
Now, you just mentioned 100 million new Wonder Bags. This is an announcement you'll be making tomorrow with Unilever. Tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, I think I probably shouldn't talk too much about it.
You can give us a flavour.
It's really about Unilever and other partners saying, we have already partnered with the Wonder Bag. You know, we can do 10, 20 million Wonder Bags, but the impact of 100 million Wonder Bags, and to say it in simple language, Steve, is that the more people that come to the party, the bigger the impact. And so many conferences, everybody goes around saying, let's do this, let's do that, let's look at the next sustainability project. But if we can encourage people to join forces rather than to go their separate ways, the impact as a global response on adaptation projects and economic development is so much greater. And so I think that's what we're looking at tomorrow, is really getting people who put their money where their mouth is.
Yes, the sort of thing that actually doesn't always necessarily happen, particularly at something like Davos. People are quite happy to say they'll do something, but whether they actually put their money there is perhaps a sometimes another issue. Well, Sarah, best of luck with that. Sarah Collins, founder of Wonderbag, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Thank you, Steve.
And I'm afraid that is pretty much all we have time for today here on Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Manon Spindler, our studio manager, Sam Impey, here in Davos, and Alex Funnell back in London. And indeed, thank you to everyone here at Holland House who has made us feel so welcome at this former health clinic. Luckily, no one got ill, but you know, it was fine. The news is going to be next, and then after that, it's this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. And in 3 hours' time, that's 2300 hours Davos time, 2200 hours in London, Louise Beale and Andrew Muller will be there with The Monocle Daily. On The Monocle Daily, you can hear more from our interview with Ian Bremmer. He's talking about the US in that segment. And I'll also be there to give a rundown of the day's events here in Davos. Now, and don't forget, tomorrow, The Globalist will have a bit more from Davos. Then we'll be co-hosting The Briefing. That's 1200 hours London time. And of course, we'll be back with a full hour of Midori House from Holland House here at Davos. But for now, thank you very much for listening. From all of us here at Holland House in Davos in the Swiss Alps, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.